Hi, this is Scott Wilkinson, host of Home Theater Geeks. In episode 196, I chat with Ron Williams about what he learned at the Hollywood Post-Alliance Tech Retreat about what's new from Hollywood. So stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Home Theater Geeks is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Home Theater Geeks with Scott Wilkinson, recorded February 27th, 2014. Episode 196, What's New from Hollywood? Hey there, Scott Wilkinson here, the Home Theater Geek and Director of Content at AVSForum.com. This week's guest geek is Ron Williams, a returning guest who has just returned, in fact, from the Hollywood Post-Alliance Tech Retreat, where he learned all the latest technology news for the Hollywood post-production community, and that's what we're going to talk about today. Hey, Ron, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Scott. Good to be back.
Always glad to have you here. Now, those Thank who you. Are watching live at live.twit.tv or logged into the chat room at irc.twit.tv can post questions for Ron as we go, and I'll pass along as many as I can. So, Ron, you just spent a few days out in lovely Palm Springs, which is where this tech retreat happens every year, and must have been lovely.
It was beautiful. The facility that the HPA has is great. The weather was perfect. But the hours were grueling. We started breakfast at 7 a.m.
Ouch.
And it ran until they finished the dinner at around 10:30. And, of course, the geeks get together in the hotel bar and you talk until midnight. And then you have to turn around and get back up at 5:30 in the morning. And you do that for 4 days. So,
That is not a pleasant thing. Although I guess people in that industry often have to get up super early. For shooting, maybe not for post-production, but certainly for filming and shooting stuff, often you have to get up super early, right?
That's very true. But the post guys, they do the all-nighters, so I'll take the early call.
All right. Well, we're going to go over a few points that, presentations that were made at this tech retreat and talk about what they mean, particularly for consumers, which is where we like to spend our time here on Home Theater Geeks. So what would you say was one of the more important things that was talked about at the retreat?
Oh, they had such a great thing. Schedule and programming that was Eileen Kramer put together was just terrific. The technology discussions this year were to where we're going and exactly where we're what we're moving into. And that has a lot to do with the consumers and social media. And for production and post-production, it's another jump forward from carrying the audio and video signals on coaxes, going over to IP, Cat5 cables, and just upping the technology steps, which the long and the short of it makes it more economical for post houses and production companies to do things and then turn it around and distribute it out on several other channels other than the conventional cable or broadcast. Mm-hmm. The internet, Netflix, et cetera, are becoming more and more popular and dominating the eyeballs, so which is a big issue.
And right, exactly. In fact, you mentioned to me off the air that, where was it here? That cable shows. Oh, no, that was terrestrial. We'll get to that in a minute. But that audio and video over IP was one of the big issues that was discussed there.
Yes. In the demo room, which is kind of like a hardware fair, but the unique thing is with HPA, the criteria for being there is it has to be brand new this year and deliverable and new technology that has not been introduced. And with that criteria, there were two manufacturers that had in a production, post-production facility, it's a router where you bring everything in, and then from several different places, you can choose what you want when you want it. So it's routing audio and video in different places. And conventionally, they've had one for audio cables, which was a big spaghetti mess, and one for video, and that also. But now they've got it combined to run audio and video on one single Cat 5. And with that, the software inside these routers allow you to do many things with that image, but it's all done in software and it's not done physically anymore. So that is a huge step forward in our industry. And there's more and more cameras and other devices, they're outputting an IP signal rather than audio and separate video. So that is huge. That's big.
And that's within the post community, within a post-production house or a facility where they're actually creating this stuff. Right. That, I guess, makes it less expensive. It's a less expensive option for them, more efficient, perhaps?
Both. It is far more efficient and more economical to do. And as anything else, when the professionals get it perfected, it trickles down into the consumer. So we know that now the consumer has Netflix and other things coming out of the cable box on a Cat 5 and putting the Cat 5 right into your TV. It's kind of going step in step, which is really pretty great for technology.
Mm-hmm. Not only coming in from the internet or the cloud, but also distributing around the house. We're certainly seeing a lot of audio and video being distributed by IP and internet protocol, that stands for. And likely to see much more of that in the future, I guess, huh?
Oh, yes. I think that's in a short period of time, I think faster than anyone really realizes that will be it. There is no doubt. I mean, we had talked before that there are several manufacturers that are actually putting Roku inside the TV, which is
right.
Like huge.
Yeah, we saw that at CES. TCL and Hisense were two of the Chinese companies anyway that were doing it, and they were the ones that were sort of touting it the most, I think, at CES. But we would expect to see that moving forward, that much more stuff is going to be coming from the cloud, as it were, from online than ever before. But still in all, terrestrial broadcasting is gaining some ground too, isn't it?
Yes, they had a statistic, I think, in this last year and a half that terrestrial-only broadcasting to the home had increased 14%.
That's amazing to me. I would have thought it would be continuing to decline as more and more people went to the internet or a lot of people are on cable or satellite.
Well, I think you touched on it there. What it is that they are seeing that they can get their shows on demand through Netflix and other outlets. But if they just want to watch television, why pay a cable company just to watch television? And their specific shows, they can get on the internet. So they really don't need cable anymore. And I think a contributing factor to that is the economy. When things kind of went down, they looked around and says, what can I cut from my budget here? You know, I don't have the money. And a lot of people said, well, hey, I can kill cable because I can get it out over the air. And that's exactly what's happening. And I think that's now snowballing, that people realize they can get a very high quality signal from over the air into their HD system. And, gee, I don't really need to have that cable bill.
Well, of course, over the air is going to give you the major networks and your local channels. But what about things like Discovery Channel or TLC or the Movie Channel or any of those kind of things that are on cable? How are people going to get those?
Well, I think they're getting them over the internet. And there are also cable shows, channels, outlets, whatever you want to call them, like Ion Television and This TV. They're on cable channels, but they're now, I see, moving over into broadcast subchannels.
So they're moving to terrestrial.
Right.
And they're exactly. What, buying subchannels from the carriers, say NBC exactly. or whoever's actually broadcasting
the broadcasters, like here in LA, we have KTLA Channel 5. There's Channel 5-1, which is their standard programming. And then there's 2, which is Antenna TV, which is a network of old 50, 60 shows. And then this is another network that's on 5-3, which just runs movies, classic, or I should say popular movies of different eras. And that is gaining more and more ground because they find that, okay, I don't have to sit and watch standard commercial television with all these commercials. I can go over to 5.3 and watch these great movies with limited commercial interruptions. So the dynamic of the whole thing is kind of changing. Although we see the cable companies getting bigger and bigger, and
that Comcast and Time Warner announced that they're going to merge,
exactly,
which is going to be huge. And I ran a poll on AVS Forum about that. I said, and I asked, you know, do you think this is a good thing or a bad thing for consumers? And it's like, you know, 80%+ said it's a bad thing. You know, because it's more like a monopoly. So that could in fact, come back to bite them in the butt, don't you think?
Well, you got to consider that one owns Universal and the other owns Warner Brothers. So you've got two major studios feeding libraries into the cable channels again. So they're buying programming. I don't think the subscriptions, you know, that's the revenue, that's the money. But I think in order to keep people in that genre, they have to have good programming, and now they have these movie libraries. So that's a big plus to them.
Now, another area of over the air that I find very interesting is this company, Aereo.
Yes, they've been in this legal battle for about a year now, and they are up and down with the courts. Actually, Jim did a Washington lawyer that comes every year to HPA. He gives us an update on how I'm looking for a nice word to use. Our legislature is doing.
Remember, this is a family friendly show here.
And what they're doing with communications, and the Aereo has been up and down in the courts. Some courts are saying it's legal for them to do it, and some courts are saying it's not legal for them to do it.
And, now, let's remind everybody what Aereo is.
Well, they're taking over-the-air broadcast and putting it on the internet, basically.
Right. And they're only available in a few markets right now. They started in New York.
Yes.
my niece actually was just visiting me from Atlanta and said they have it there, and that's how she gets her TV. Or over-the-air TV, anyways, through Aereo, which, again, is sort of combining terrestrial broadcasting with IP, which is, I think, a fascinating model.
Well, the crux of the whole thing, to just oversimplify it, is that there is this little bit chip that goes onto the device. And their legal stance is, well, it's an antenna. And as long as you're receiving it over the air from an antenna, then you could do anything you want with it. And to the true sense of the word, that's true. But the broadcasters don't see it that way. They say what you're doing is rebroadcasting our signal for profit. And they don't like that.
Right. I think Aereo also offers cloud-based DVR service too, right? I mean, if you are a subscriber, you can tell the system to record something. It's not recording on your local box in your house, but rather at Aereo's facility. But then you can call for it anytime you want.
I believe that's true. Yes, that's another gap, because then when you play it back, you fast forward through all the commercials and they don't like that either.
Right. Exactly right.
But then again, that's not much different than what we do with the normal shows that we record, and then I'm guilty of it. I fall into the binge watching because I travel so much. I'll record, my favorite is Justified. I'll record four weeks of that, and then when I sit down, I just sit down and watch them all at once, fast-forwarding through. So I'm guilty of it. This is becoming the norm, actually.
Yeah, exactly. Web6135 mentions that terrestrial quality is so much better than cable or satellite. And I have to agree. I've always said, you know, the terrestrial broadcasting is probably the best way to get broadcast television, certainly better than over the internet, which means that they have to compress it so much more to make it fit through the pipes. So there is a reason for being glad that terrestrial is expanding.
Well, for the number geeks out there, is the broadcast, you know, it's 19.2 meg, and the best you're going to get off a direct TV is something like 8 or 9.
Mm.
Cable is somewhere down about 5 to 7. You know, so you get a
and the internet is and the internet is more like, well, you it depends. Netflix will tell you, well, if you have only 3 megabits coming in, then we'll give you this much quality, or 6, we'll give you this much quality. So in that sense, it's adaptable to whatever you have coming in, which is a good thing, at least in the case of Netflix and probably some other providers as well.
Mm. That's now, true. So the over-the-air is always far better. I always like to throw the jab when the Time Warner guy comes out, because the cable is so bad here, and he gets it working, and I'll go flop between the same show off the antenna and off of Time Warner, and he'll stand there and go, oh, my God, look at the difference. I said, yeah, aren't you guys doing a good job? Good job.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you so very much. Now, one of the things that was mentioned at the HPA Tech Retreat is the next generation, in fact, of terrestrial broadcasting, ATSC 3.0. ATSC standing for Advanced Television Systems Committee, the group that put together HD broadcasting and superseded NTSC, National Television Systems Committee, which was the standard definition organizing body. And we've been watching ATSC, I guess, 2.0 now for a while, and here comes 3.0. What can you tell us about it?
Well, yes, 2.0 was from the inception, and that's what we have now. And they're
there was never a 1.0?
There was, but nobody ever saw it.
Oh, okay.
Actually, I think that was the testing that they did in two television stations in North Carolina, to tell you the truth, where that was. But the 3.0 is far more robust. It has data link communications that's possible to go two-way, so you can do interactive over the air.
So you can transmit. You can transmit from your house back up to the broadcaster,
depending on the box that you have. Mm. You can do that, but that right now, I think their testing is over the phone line. Their return is on the phone.
Okay. I think it is with satellite, or it has been anyway, with satellite internet service. If you're getting your downstream internet from a satellite, you still have to send it upstream by the phone lines or whatever. I mean, people don't normally have a strong satellite transmitter on their roof.
That'd be tough, yeah. But you're right. That's exactly how they do that. I know that Dish has got an agreement with a company, the service provider for the internet, and that's how they do it. It comes down off the satellite, but it goes back up through the phone lines.
Right.
But anyways, 3.0 is designed to be far more robust to allow different things to happen at the same time. Where a broadcaster could possibly, which was one of the original things with what 1080 to 720, because 720p that ABC, PBS, Fox use versus 1080i, which is NBC and CBS.
Right.
It's a smaller bandwidth. So at one point at the beginning, because it was progressive scan, there was a few computer companies that said, well, gee, how about if we just buy that extra little space there, that bandwidth, and I could download Windows updates. I could download this or that to the home because it's coming in there and it's a direct pipe. And that didn't get much traction, but that was the thought at the beginning. Now with 3.0, they're going back to, well, gee, we can drop data services and other information into the home over the air. And or the broadcaster can use that bandwidth for other things. So, yeah, that's on the offing coming too.
Mm-hmm. When do we expect that to be rolled out? Are they in trials now in some markets?
Yes, back east. I think, it's, again, they're still back in North Carolina. I don't know what the affinity of that is, but they're still in the testing phase of 3.0, for sure.
Do we expect that this year, next year?
Oh, probably at least 3 to 4 years.
3 to 4 years out, okay.
Because you got to remember, now, all of the set manufacturers have to change their receivers.
Yep. Yeah,
so that's they need at least 2 to 3 years lead time to start changing the receivers. Once the standard is on.
Yeah, I guess most TVs still do have over-the-air tuners in them. I guess they probably can't avoid it. Because I was thinking, well, where else would you get it? You there are a few set-top boxes separate that would allow it, but I think for the most part, you're right. They need to be in the TV, and changing over hardware like that is always a fairly lengthy process, as we're seeing with HDMI 2.0.
Yeah.
That's another kettle of fish, isn't it?
Yeah. Thank you for bringing that one up.
yeah. Well, just to finish that thought, as we've talked about on this show before, you know, a lot of manufacturers are now claiming they have HDMI 2.0 implemented in their TVs and their AV receivers and so on, Blu-ray players, but it's not really. I mean, it sort of is. It can implement certain parts of HDMI 2.0, but the hardware is still limited in bandwidth to 10.2 gigabits per second. Right. And true HDMI 2.0 calls for 18 gigabits per second. But that also requires new hardware, and the hardware hasn't even been released to the manufacturers yet. So we're not going to see true HDMI 2.0 for at least a year.
That's very true. That's very true. And with the UHD coming out, and they say, oh, well, you can use the HDMI port. Well, if you're under 30 frames, it'll work. But you get above 30 frames, you got nothing. So it's... kind of iffy. Of course, it's no surprise. I think I said it here last time we spoke on the air that I'm a big fan of DisplayPort.
Right.
And DisplayPort covers all bases, but you know, DisplayPort is kind of like Linux. You know, it's a great thing, works well. People who have it love it, but nobody owns it. So there's no marketing, there's no push, there's no drive to get it done. So Linux sits where it is, and DisplayPort sits over here where it is. So
it sits with the computers, whereas HDMI sits over with the consumer electronics. Right. I think you and I have talked also off the air about this, and my contention is that HDMI is so entrenched in the consumer marketplace on TVs and AVRs and Blu-ray players and other set-top boxes and all this gear that making room for another type of connector is expensive for manufacturers and it's confusing to consumers. So I don't see it's likely to happen.
Well, besides the computer monitors, I know that Samsung and LG have a few television that have display ports on them.
Oh, you know what? You're right. I hadn't remembered that. So maybe there is a hope.
we're hoping that UHD goes over into DisplayPort.
Yeah, exactly. Speaking of UHD, you certainly, I'm sure, saw a bunch of stuff at HPA about that and its relationship to quote-unquote 4K.
Oh, boy. You're walking around with one of these. It was kind of funny that there were a couple of presenters that went to an explanation of that 4K is 4096 and UHD or quad is 3840 by 2160p.
Right.
And they made a point of this and they go in their presentation and then I had to shake my head and wait a minute. He's referring to everything as 4K. And he just got finished saying, don't call it 4K.
Don't call it 4K. And by the way, we're calling it 4K. What?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, man.
But as you saw at CES, because the CEA put out to the manufacturers is call it UHD, not 4K, because it's not 4K and it's a misnomer to the public and misleading. Don't do it. So then we saw that they would say that it's 4K, small letters, 3840 by 2160, or they'd say 4K, down over here, UHD. Right. So they kind of hedged that whole thing that way. But I see a lot of manufacturers going into NAB this year, the National Association of Broadcasters Convention in Las Vegas. They're saying the big one is UHD/4K.
Mm-hmm. I'm afraid that's how I've started doing it on AVS too, because it's difficult to get around the fact that everyone or most people are calling it 4K, even if it's not.
It's easy because it rolls off the tongue really easy, 4K. Mm-hmm.
Which is why the manufacturers are doing it that way. Besides the fact that it's a, you know, a nice fancy number.
bigger is better, right?
Bigger is better. Yeah, exactly. But as Joe Kane has pointed out, we've gone from referring to consumer resolutions by their vertical resolution, that is 480p, which is 480 pixels top to bottom, 720, which is 720 top to bottom, 1080, which is 1080 up top to bottom. Now we're calling it 4K, which is the horizontal resolution. So that right there is a piece of confusion, well, I think.
I know Joe and several others refer to it as 2160p.
Right, exactly, which would be totally consistent with what we call it, what we call HD in every other format we've seen so far. And I would like to do that too.
Marketing people love those big numbers.
By the way, Beatmaster in the chat room, getting back to DisplayPort, says, there are many DisplayPort to HDMI adapters on the market, so it shouldn't be too intrusive. But the problem I see with that is that HDMI, even HDMI 2.0, is 18 gigabits per second. What's DisplayPort? DisplayPort's up to version 1.2, I think, or
1.3. And It's kind of almost unlimited because DisplayPort is not a format. It's just a great big pipe. And the chips on the other end decide what it's going to be.
Oh, so it could be almost anything.
Right.
That's so the beauty of it. All you have to do is make chips that, yeah, okay, all right.
That's the beauty of it.
Okay.
And well, anyway, now they have, they showed it at CES, but I've seen it in other applications where they take a DisplayPort into a USB hub, and then they run DisplayPort on USB connectors and cables. So if you bring in a feed and you wanted to do, say, a quad split on a computer monitor, but you wanted to feed each one of those four pictures full monitor resolutions to four side-by-side monitors, you can do that. I mean, it's pretty amazing what DisplayPort will do. Mm. And you're pushing it around on a USB connector and USB hubs.
Yeah. Is there any kind of handshaking issue with DisplayPort? Because HDMI, man, that can be a real pain.
Well, you know, no, there isn't. But now that you brought that up, one of the other little ugly things that I think anybody that deals with AV stuff, our nice little friend, the MPAA and their copy protection, the HDCP.
Right. HDCP,
DisplayPort doesn't have HDCP.
Well, there's the real reason why it's not going to be in consumer products is that the content owners won't allow it because they want to protect their content.
Well, they do, but, you know, let's be real about it. How significant is it today? I mean, the standard consumer who buys typical stuff, a setup from whatever outlet, and he plugs it in and it does the handshake and everybody's happy, the EDID is okay, we're great. That's not the guy that's going to do anything off color. You know, it's kind of like locks are good for some respects, but the people who want to get around it, they're already today are getting around it.
Yes. So it's true. It's a vain war. It's like other wars I can think of that, you know, that thinks that copy protection will save the bad guy, will prevent the bad guys from, you know, stealing the content because they can get around anything. Anything that can be encoded or encrypted can be hacked. Eventually it will be.
You know, it's like a padlock. Padlocks are there for honest people.
QNX Monkey in the chat room is saying DisplayPort 1.2 is currently 17 gigabits per second. 1.3 is expected to be up to 40 gigabits per second. Right. Now, that would be really, really good for UHD because, as we know, HDMI 2.0 is all when it finally gets implemented in hardware and chipsets that manufacturers put in their products, it's already going to be limited. Yes. You know, you can't do 10 or 12 bit color at 444 subsampling, even with HDMI 2.0 fully implemented.
That's correct. That's correct. It has a lot of limitations. And that's why, you know, I stated earlier that us kind of like in the know, we're very much pro DisplayPort and would like to see it going. And there are Korean manufacturers have decided that, going into UHD with bigger and better pictures and 12-bit and, you know, as you say, 444, we're going to need a bigger pipe. So let's just put the bigger pipe in there now and we'll worry about the stuff later.
Yeah.
But, of course, they still don't have 2020 color in those displays. But that's a whole nother show.
So it is. Just for those who are listening and might not understand these terms, 2020 refers to ITU recommended color specifications, 2020, which is a much wider range of colors than we currently have in the current HD system, which is called Rec 709. And some companies certainly have a wider range of colors, what's called the color gamut, than Rec 709, but it's not standardized. Sony might have a wider range of colors, but it'll be different than the wider range of colors from Panasonic or Sharp or somebody else. So that's one thing that I wanted to ask you about, Ron, at HPA. If anybody had talked about standardizing these other elements for UHD or 4K, a particular wider color gamut, a particular number of bits, dynamic range is another one we haven't mentioned yet. All of these things, you know, all the display manufacturers are focused on is resolution. Oh, we've got four times the number of pixels of HD, so see how much better it is. But it doesn't make much difference, especially on a smaller screen, especially at the distance people normally sit, like, say, 10 feet. So these other elements, specifically high dynamic range, wider color gamut, those are going to be much more immediately obvious as big improvements. But they're not standardized yet. What's the news on that front?
Well, I'm just kind of looking at my notes here. There were two papers pretty much along those lines. And the better pixels, best bang for the buck was one of the topics.
Yes. Probably Dolby was involved in that one.
Yes, our good Pat Griffiths. It was a panel discussion. And the premise is, as you pointed out, the display manufacturers say more pixels, and NHK's got an 8K system, you know, that they're testing out right now. And the panel's discussion is, let's not go so crazy getting bigger resolution. Let's make a really good picture at the resolution we have now, which goes back to a throwback many years ago when HD was coming out. Actually, it was with our friend Joe Kane. We had an NTSC monitor that we set up correctly according to SMPTE specifications.
NTSC being standard definition.
Right. Next to a high-definition monitor. And people would come by and they'd look at it and say, well, what format is this high-definition? Well, it's NTSC. It's standard def. No, that can't be standard def. Standard def never looked that good. So it's the same thing as we're in right now. If we take HD, you know, it's known we can do HD very, very well. But if you put high dynamic range, higher frame rate, and a few of these elements into what we have now, it makes a phenomenally great picture, a wider color gamut. Going to UHD, if you go into these and you put the high dynamic range and frame rate in it and a few other things, the picture gets to be quite outstanding. But if you don't take the picture element quality along with the resolution, you're just making smaller pixels on a bigger screen.
Right.
And you're not really gaining anything.
Yep.
Well, except for the Pacific Rim companies are selling more televisions. That's about what they're doing.
Well, you know, they have to have something new to sell people, you know, every year, every few years. And 3D didn't really work out quite as planned. So this is the next number, 4K. Next time it'll be 5-something. Who knows?
Well, that's why when we brought up the topic of the 2020, and I'm glad you brought that up with that and frame rate and color gamut. If you put all of these picture enhancements into what we have, it does get better.
No question.
Will the standard rank and file consumer really know the difference? You know, probably not. But
I don't know. When it comes to high dynamic range anyway, I bet you they will, because it's so dramatic. I mean, it's really dramatic. You've seen it, I'm sure.
Oh, yes. Quite so. Yeah, with the Academy, you know, Tech Council is
exactly, you
know, doing such things, and it's making it a lot better.
But as I said at the start of this particular part of the conversation, things haven't been standardized yet. What's the status of SMPTE, the Society of Motion Picture and Television Engineers, who more or less are the governing body of standards for TV in this country anyway? What's the status of that in terms of UHD and adding these extra elements?
Peter Sines, the Vice President of Engineering for SMPTE, did his annual report. And the UHD standard, and there are actually 5 documents encompassing that umbrella title. They're mostly all finished being written. They're in the process of being ratified and voted on right now. And so the core document has been basically passed, but there are some addendums to it that are now in the process. So I'd like to see, or I'll venture a guess by the end of the year, we'll have a full UHD standard document, which encompasses the production flow, the workflow there, the transmission, monitors, and reception. And that would include the high dynamic range, 2020 color, and encoding, and et cetera, for that signal.
Mm-hmm. The real question, I guess, is when that document is finished, will the manufacturers abide by those standards?
Well, then again, the SMPTE documents are what we in the production side, production, post-production, that's our Bible. That's the law. Once the SMPTE standard is out, everybody complies, because all the manufacturers will comply.
So the manufacturers of consumer products, so the reception end and the display end, would have to abide by it if they wanted to reproduce what the content creators are making accurately.
And that last part of your sentence is the point. If they want to, they will do it.
And hopefully they do.
Yes. Well, we've been battling several issues with the manufacturers on the Pacific Rim for quite a long time. They feel that they can make a better picture cheaper than the way we create the content. And I've had a lot of discussions, like we spend, you know, $200 million making a movie, and just throw big names around, you know, I said, tell them, you know, Steven Spielberg approves the transfer in the DI room. He writes a check saying, this is what I want, how I want it, and it's represented as my way. And I explained that I don't think it's up to design engineers anywhere on the Pacific Rim to say, oh, Steven, I don't know what the hell he's talking about. We think it looks better this way. So it's always a give and take there.
It really is, yeah. Now, didn't at the HPA retreat, didn't Movie Labs propose something for standardizing high dynamic range and wide color gamut?
Yes, they had a group talk about that. And that was basically the group that I was talking to before the SMPTE conversation is they feel dealing with these picture elements is a better way to get a better picture and product out to the consumer than it is to keep going to 4K, 8K, 16K and get crazy with resolution.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's a lot of people say to me when we talk about 4K or UHD, a lot of people are saying, well, why don't we just wait? I mean, 8K is around the corner. NHK, the Japanese broadcasting company, is working on 8K now, and 16K must be beyond that, and 32, and so on and so on, ad infinitum. Let's just wait. And I always say, well, yeah, but if you wait, then you're never going to get anywhere. You're never going to do anything.
Well, my opinion on that is you can get more and more resolution, and they're selling more and more televisions. But we know the human eye acuity has a point of cutoff.
Right.
And it's cut off somewhere about actually 3K is where it's cut off.
Mm-hmm. So depending on how close you sit to the screen.
Well, that's true. But when you condense the pixels, if you keep a 50-inch set in your 4K or 8K, what you're doing is condensing pixels.
Right. So they're making them smaller.
The picture only gets better if your nose is 6 inches away from the screen.
Right.
Okay.
So which is hardly convenient or reasonable to expect anybody to watch TV that way.
Right. Well, if you're sitting at a computer monitor, well, where we are right now looking at our screens, we're, 24 inches maybe.
Yeah, a couple feet away.
Yeah. And that would work in that respect. But if you have, Joe has that, what is it, an 85-inch UHD?
He does. The Samsung 85-inch, the UN 85S9.
And when you sit, half picture height away from that thing, it's plenty. You've got peripheral vision is taken in. You've got the height is there. You're immersed in it kind of like you are with IMAX. I mean, the picture is bigger than your sight peripheral. So how much more do you really need? You know, 8K is not buying you anything more than the 3840. And I think 3840 is a good place just to stop for quite a long time.
That's horizontal resolution, by the way. That's what people are calling 4K, but it's actually 3840 right to left and 2160 up and down, just to make sure everybody understands.
Right. And my opinion is that, well, we've done some testing that for UHD, the theoretical minimum size is 65-inch.
Lower than that, and you're not really going to see a difference unless you're right up against the screen.
Yeah, you're not gaining anything with a smaller screen. So if someone says, well, I'll get a 50-inch UHD, my recommendation is save your money. Just stick with HD and you're fine.
Yeah.
Because you're not going to see much difference there at all. Not at all.
Right. Exactly. getting back to streaming content, I know that you mentioned something that was talked about there at the retreat about Google and YouTube have a new encoder. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. The two guys from Google were brought out and did the explanation of their new encoding for YouTube, which makes it files about a little more than half the size with a better picture. And that's something that they came up with. What we didn't quite understand is that it's optimized for Chrome Media.
Now,
whatever the hell that is.
Okay, they didn't really explain that too well, I guess.
No, they were very adamant that it works perfectly on Chrome Media. And it was like, well, are you guys here explaining this encoding method to us, or are you selling Chrome? But nonetheless, it's not necessary to have Chrome Media to take advantage of this because they stream it off as YouTube as what it is. But they are trying. There is a statistic that I had something like 5,000 YouTube videos are uplinked every minute.
You mean are uploaded to YouTube?
Yeah. Yeah, some crazy number. And they're storing all of this stuff. So what they're looking for is a way to shrink the size
for archival purposes.
And then to get it faster out to you.
Yeah,
so this new algorithm and system that they have, they're very proud of. And it made a lot of sense. And, going through the math and et cetera, it's a very good thing, in my opinion.
Well, but it's in its infancy, I think, at this point, right? So we're not going to see it next week.
No, not next week. They didn't say exactly when they're going to roll it out, but they've done the testing and the beta testing with it. So it should be soon. Now, I don't even know if they make a big deal out of it. They may just
not make any big stink about it. Certainly, right. We know that YouTube is one of the online sources that has talked a lot about starting to stream 4K or UHD content, along with Netflix, Amazon Instant Video, I think. MGo was another one, I think, that was announced, at least in conjunction with Samsung. So there are quite a few and a growing number of online resources or outlets that are going to start streaming 4K. And they're going to need a more efficient codec in order to do that and have it look any good at all.
Right. And they're working, towards these ends. And whom has more money to do R&D than Google?
Who does?
I say, who does? Who has more money than Google to do it?
Probably nobody. Yeah, okay. I see your point. Yeah.
Everybody's going to do it. They're going to do it for sure.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Sure. Somehow I thought you were referring to a Chinese name, which was just my hearing.
Yeah.
Although that does bring up my mistake does bring up an interesting point that I wanted to at least touch upon, which is you mentioned earlier that Roku was being integrated into TVs, and I mentioned that it was primarily Chinese TVs. And you and I aren't the only ones who think that China is really going to come to dominate the consumer electronics, especially TV marketplace, in the near future.
Well, our good friend Pete Putnam, who did this CES wrap-up, which he does every year at HPA, his conclusion on several of his points, changing topics through his presentation, he mentioned that, China is going to be the dominant force here. I mean, he said, make no mistake, they will dominate this in the next 4 to 5 years.
Mm.
So,
as I've said, China will do to Korea what Korea did to Japan in terms of becoming dominant in the consumer marketplace.
And I think you're right. The Koreans, although it was statistically here in the news, Samsung is now the world's largest manufacturer of phones, of smartphones. They hold the biggest market share in that. And LG is close behind. So when you look at that force in that market, but then they're making good headway in maintaining their foothold in consumer displays. But God, the Chinese, everything that Pete brought up in his presentation that you and I saw at CES, my God, they're everywhere. And they have the brands, by the way. I think, the listeners should understand that trade names like RCA is Chinese. Sylvania is Chinese.
In other words, the Chinese bought the rights to use those names.
Right. They bought the trade name, and now they're manufacturing. And, we have a big generation, myself included, of course, my parents and all, that you bought an RCA or a Zenith, and by God, you had the best. Well, they're still around, and so when a product is in, Best Buy or Target or somewhere and it says RCA, they're thinking, oh, God, this has got to be great because it's an RCA.
Right.
Because nobody knows, very few people are doing what we're doing is sitting here saying, hey, these trade names are actually Chinese companies.
Right. And they may or may not be good.
Well, I'm not taking anything away from them because, they – they have some really great products, you know, and Pete pointed that out. He said he was really surprised at his evaluation of some of those monitors and TVs. He said they're incredible. They're great. They got a lot of nice features in them, and they're cheap.
Yeah, and they're cheap.
But then again, didn't they say that about Japan when they came out with the radios and things like that? Well, it was made in Japan. It was a cheap product, but it's not.
Right, right. And they said the same thing about Korea. You know, Samsung used to be an LG. I remember when LG was Gold Star. LG actually stood for Lucky Gold Star. And that was the brand you bought in the drugstore, in the pharmacy.
Yes, yes.
You know, and Samsung the same. And now they're both premium brands.
Yes, yeah. Well, quite you amazing. pour enough money into it, you get quality.
Exactly. Who is it? Oh, Eric Duckman in the chat room said, they better decide on resolutions and stick with them for a while. I expect my TV to last 10 to 20 years, not three.
Well, to answer his question on that, I came from that generation myself, where I have a TV that you expected to last 15 years. But I'll tell you, in the grand scheme of things, from what we've seen of the LCD, the early LCDs, at about 7 to 8 years, they're failing. So I the idea of 15 years for a television, God, I wish it were true, but I don't think so.
It's kind of not true anymore, is it?
No, it's not.
I don't think so either. I don't think so either. Sadly, I wish it were. But aside from the fact that, I don't know, maybe the quality control or the parts they're using or whatever, things start to fail sooner. But also technology is moving along much faster than it did in our parents' or grandparents' generation, such that, you know, they were able to keep a TV for 20 years because, you know, the technology didn't change. Now, you know, we're getting more resolution, we're getting more dynamic range and so on and so forth. And technology, the actual display technology is changing. We went from fluorescent tubes illuminating LCD TVs to now LEDs illuminating those TVs. We've gone from plasmas being really the best picture to now they're almost gone. I mean, they still provide a really good picture, but they don't sell as well. So they're disappearing from the market altogether.
Yeah, that the newer technologies, along with the components, you know, as they advance, it's again to make a better product cheaper. So as the technology moves forward, I can't help. I have no proof or basis of this. It's just my opinion that I think that it's kind of like built-in obsolescence because they know that the rollover is going to turn in that 7-year mark. And so we'll build another television or go into a different standard, and that'll push things. But as you and I had agreed about 5-10 minutes ago, you know, you get to 2160p, put the brakes on for quite a while and just give us a better picture, and that's enough.
Yes.
So
yes.
To his question, I agree with you. Stop at 2160p.
Loquacious One in the chat room says, she remembers the Zenith TV with a clicker remote. You remember those clicker remotes?
Yeah. Oh, yes. Oh, absolutely. Oh, yes.
Those were actually tuning forks that sent ultrasonic sound to a receiver in the TV that told it to go up one channel or down one channel. Right. I remember those as well.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, that's gone. That is gone.
Sadly so. Well, speaking of new display technologies, what did you hear, if anything, about laser illuminated projectors? This is a subject of great interest to me, you know, because projectors have these big white hot lamps that only last maybe 1,000 hours. And then you got to replace them in the home for a few $100. The Sony VW600ES Ultra HD projector, the bulb costs $700. Now, lasers are going to last tens of thousands of hours. So what's the latest on that?
Well, Peter Lede did a presentation. Find my notes here. And he has an organization that is trying to get LIPA, is trying to get the state's safety regulations all in unison. Because right now, there's only, I think he said, 21 states that have a regulation that would allow the technology as it exists today to be used in a theater for a theater projector.
Really?
The other states' regulations don't allow that because some of the states feel that the danger, the radiation, if somebody stood up in the theater and looked up into it, they would burn their eyeballs out and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Of course, none of that's true. But
right.
The states' regulations have not been changed to reflect the newer technologies. So in order to use a certain grade of laser projector in a theater, it has to meet this criteria. And Peter's group, the LIPA, that's their mission. And he went through and he explained, you know, one of the reasons why they're not, you know, is more available, even though if everybody agreed upon it, is that they're still having a little bit of trouble with the blue laser. It has a lot of scatter. That's an element that if you take your little red laser pointer for your presentations and you point it at the screen, you see all the little dots all around it. That's scatter.
I've heard it called speckle.
Speckle, scatter, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Different names for the same thing, yeah.
Different name for the same thing. And that in the power output for the blue and getting the filtering correct is something I've been working on actually a quite long time. I would say 10 years that I know of that they've been working on that. And the companies that are doing that heavy R&D have been bought and sold a couple times because they just keep pouring money into R&D and don't come up with anything. They end up going bankrupt. Uh-huh. But big companies are now working on that because of everything you just said about, you know, the longevity, the cost, et cetera. Of course, they have much wider color gamut. You know, when I was chairman of DC-28 for SMPTE, which is a digital cinema, I proposed the color gamut of CAP-XYZ, which is the basis of all color. The RGB system came out of CAP-XYZ.
Cap and meaning capital X, capital Y, capital Z, just to make sure everybody knows that, which is one way to represent color. In fact, extends beyond the range of the colors that the human eye can actually see. But
right.
If you do that, then you for sure capture everything the human eye can see.
Well, when we wrote that standard, there is a graph of the human eye spectral ability to see. It's called a locus, and it's kind of like my hand here. Let me get it on the screen.
Yeah, I'm sorry we didn't have a graphic to show it, but go ahead.
And when we wrote the standard, it goes from here way out to here. And then
right.
They came
so
back to
it. So it extends beyond the range of what we can actually see.
10 times.
Way and beyond.
And they said, well, why are you putting coordinates that far out? And then we said, well, number one, we're writing a standard, hopefully lasts 50 years. Number two is the resolution of a laser is kind of almost infinite in that spectrum. So if you go way about beyond what the eye can see, the resolution of what's in between is tighter and better. You get more broader colors rendition through the locus spectrum. So you get every color imaginable in that thing from the laser. Mm. And took the committee a long time, but they didn't finally realize that, yes, we don't know what color is going to be 50 years from now, but we do know it will be laser. Mm. So let's write a standard that encompasses everything that they're going to do for the laser. And we did. And that was part of it. So the wider color gamut that Peter's group is working with and dealing with the speckle, brightness, power efficiency, they've got new lasers now. He had graphs and charts showing how much more efficient power-wise that the lasers have become. So
plus the fact that the lasers can be separate from the projection engine. And
yes.
In fact, be located in a completely different room and fed to the projector itself, the projection engine, by fiber optic cables.
Yes.
So, you know, it becomes the heat management becomes another very important advantage of lasers over xenon or other kinds of white incandescent lamps. But one question still bothers me, and we don't have much time left, but I'd like to hear your thoughts on this. One of the problems that I see with laser illumination is that the red, green, and blue colors are very narrow bandwidth. You don't have a wide range of spectral colors. You have a sharp peak at red, a sharp peak at green, and a sharp peak at blue. Doesn't that cause certain problems?
Well, that lasers aren't that narrow as like LED lighting is extremely narrow, which is.
Well, I thought lasers were a single wavelength. I mean, they're extremely narrow, but maybe they're defocused or decorrelated to some degree before they make their image.
Well, when it hits the image, the color is the plate that it hits is making it. Yeah, you know, you're right. It kind of diffuses or scatters it out, and it makes broader spikes, and then your brain fills in the difference between the spikes, just like it does with LED lighting. LED lighting and your, CFL lights that you buy now. Yeah. If you look at those on a spectral response, and maybe we'll do a show on that, and I've got all kinds of graphs and things to show you.
Oh, good. Yeah, yeah.
How crazy this lighting is that we're now going into versus what we have seen. And what it does to your eye. I mean, it's a remarkable story.
Well, let's save that for next time. And definitely, I would love to have you come back and talk about the spectral response of different kinds of light, how that affects how people light what they're shooting for movies and TV shows, how it affects what individuals do with their photography, even the light bulbs in their house. So plenty to talk about with that. And so I do hope you will come back and join me.
Anytime you ask, Scott, I'm here to help you out.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
You can read more about Ron's work at his website, landmarkcolor.com. You can always find me online at avsforum.com. You can email me at scott@twit.tv, and you can follow me on Twitter at htgeekscott, also at avsforum on Twitter. Now, previous episodes of Home Theater Geeks are always available here at twit.tv/htg, and also on YouTube, on our YouTube channel, youtube.com/twit/HomeTheaterGeeks. Next week, my guest geek is scheduled to be Keith Yates, a home theater designer and acoustician who has worked on some really amazing home theaters, and he's got some really interesting things to say about subwoofers and speaker placement and all sorts of audio things along those lines. So I do hope you will join me for that. Until then, geek out.